Archaeological site of Kurien. First unit, location. The town of Limassol had the chance to be developed between two important ancient city kingdoms of Cyprus, Amethyst east and Kurien west. So, take direction towards the village of Episcopi in the district of Limassol, west of which, within a distance of approximately 4 kilometres, in front of you comes into view the hill that accepted to accommodate for many centuries one of the most important city kingdoms of the island, founded by the Achaean Greeks. They arrived here from the Aegean region at around 1200 BC, but Cyprus was a familiar area to them, as earlier was accommodating for almost 2 centuries the Mycenaean merchants who were searching for its precious copper. Today, Kurien is one of the most important archaeological sites on the island, visited by thousands of local and foreign tourists every year. The Department of Antiquities has recently proceeded to the creation of an archaeological park in order to protect and at the same time unify the most significant monuments of Kurien. At the entrance, you will find the custodian's office, where you can purchase the entrance ticket to visit all the monuments of the archaeological site. Then the road leads you to the parking place, situated at the northeastern end of the hill, where you will start your tour with the two most important monuments, the Greco-Roman Theatre and the House of Eustolios. Passing by the main entrance of an especially arranged reception hall, where a bookshop operates, a coffee shop and restrooms, the path will lead you to the theatre. Before proceeding to the theatre's entrance, stop for a while to see the sea from afar. The view is breathtaking. From that point on, the strolling of the eyes is starting together with the strolling of the mind and soul. Scenery of boundless beauty is unfolding before you, with the blue azure of the sea shining under the golden rays of the sun, contrasting with all kinds of golden greenish colours of the earth. And one thing is evident. The ancient Greeks knew how to choose the locations where they were going to build their cities. Imagine them approaching the southeastern coasts of the island with their small boats. They must have seen from further away the large bay with the sandy beach, where they could easily pull out their boats, as well as the abrupt steep hills, which would provide sufficient safety to the ancient inhabitants of that site. The hill of the Acropolis, where we are now, is especially impressive, almost vertical on its 3 sides. Fortification works and all public buildings of Kurien have been erected on it. So they were looking for a good location with a sea view, which in opposition to our needs of today, it was not only a matter of luxury, but an imperative necessity for safety, since they could have seen the enemy from afar and be protected. Certainly, location was not the only element when choosing the site. But as you may notice by yourselves, in front of you stretches a huge valley, and surrounding fields are particularly fertile for cultivation. At that time, possibly much more than today, people had a huge need of fertile soil, since their community mainly relied on earth and its produce. The River Kuris, which leads out into the Kurien Episcopi Bay, is another prevailing element of the scenery in the wider area. The river, which is one of the biggest of the island, was of great importance for the inhabitants of the region, since they used its water for irrigation and as a water supply. The combination of all these geophysical elements of the region made it almost ideal for founding the city. Nevertheless, in archaeological topography, the area of Kurien is one of the richest in archaeological sites on the entire island. Second unit, foundation, history. And these Kurians, inhabitants of Kurien, are calling themselves colonists from Argives. That is what Herodotus is saying in his 5th book of stories, E113. He states, namely, that the Kurians considered themselves as descendants of Argive, Achaeans, colonists. And Strabon is writing as well in the geographical description of Cyprus, 14683, then the city of Kurien, which had a port, was built by Argives. Even though it must be considered that Kurien was founded by Achaean colonists and was organised by them into a city kingdom after the massive colonisation of the island during the 12th to 11th century BC. However, there isn't any ancient tradition that has been preserved referring by name to a Greek hero as founder of the city, in opposition to many other ancient cities of Cyprus, like Salamis, Epeia, Hythroi, Idalium. Nevertheless, a similar tradition has been preserved by Stephanos Byzantios, who refers us once again on the fifth book of Herodotus, where it is mentioned that Kurion, the city of Cyprus, founded by Kurios, son of Kinyras. Kurion has been named after its founder, who was Kurios, the son of the mythical king of Paphos, Kinyras. This tradition, which connects Kurion with the son of Kinyras, does not appear to be irrelevant to the very ancient relations between the city of Kurion and more generally the kingdom of Kurion, with the neighbouring city of Paphos and the kingdom of Paphos. The first written reference to ancient cities of Cyprus is to be found in the Egyptian inscription, engraved on the walls of a temple in Medinet Habu during the reign of King Ramses III, 1198 to 1167 BC, and dating to the first quarter of the 12th century BC. It refers a total of 8 Cypriot cities. One of them is read as Kyr and has been identified as Kurion, but its complete name has not been recovered. The famous golden scepter of Kurion, discovered in a royal tomb in Kalorosiki and dating from the beginning of the 11th century BC, constitutes important evidence that the city kingdom was already founded. This scepter, exposed in the Cyprus Museum, is of outstanding craftsmanship. It has a height of 16.5 centimeters, with an enameled sphere on top and 2 falcons on it. On the other hand, it is one of the rare treasures of the Cyprus Museum, belonging to the exceptional species of Mycenaean art. Among the exceptional samples of Mycenaean art, many terracotta potteries are included, bronze items and micro-craftsmanship objects of the 13th to 12th centuries BC, discovered in tombs in the wider region of Kurion, which proves the installation of Mycenaeans here and the relations of the region with the Mycenaean civilization since the late Bronze Age. Certainly a most reliable reference for the city is to be found in the tribute list of Sargon, 673-72, where King Damasus of Kurion, Kuri, is included in the list of ancient Cypriot gods under Assyrian domination. In fact, the most ancient remains of a settlement in the wider region of Kurion, dating from the Neolithic period, 4500 to 3900 BC. On the same hill where Kurion is situated, there are remains dating from the end of the Classical period, mostly of the Hellenistic, 325 to 50 BC, and mainly of the Roman, 50 to 330 AD, and early Christian times, 330 to the end of 7th century AD. It seems that the location of Kurion during the late Bronze Age, mentioned in the foundation legend regarding the Argives, was situated in the area of Arimmi, where the remains of a part of a big settlement, which must have been the predecessor of Kurion, have recently come to light. First excavation surveys in various parts of the city site and surroundings of Kurion, which clearly had an amateurish and treasure-hunting orientated character, were undertaken in 1873 by the renowned Luigi Palma di Cesnola. The famous treasure of Kurion is included among the numerous movable finds originating from these superficial and irresponsible surveys, and nowadays they are decorating the rooms of the Metropolitan Museum of New York. Cesnola claims that this treasure, which consists of precious and invaluable jewels of different types and dates, was discovered near the theatre of Kurion. Nevertheless, systematic excavations in Kurion were started in 1933 by the Pennsylvania University Museum and were carried out with some interruptions until 1954. In 1964, the Department of Antiquities started its excavation survey on the site. Between 1974 to 79, the American mission of the Dumbarton Oaks Centre for Byzantine Studies undertook the excavations of the Bishop's Paleo-Christian Basilica. The American mission of Walter's Art Gallery and the Universities of Missouri and Maryland excavated Curion Hill during the period of 1980 to 1983. Third unit, the theatre. Tell me, ye muses, under whom, beneath what chiefs of royal awe, of humble note, stood forth the embattled Greeks, the host at large? If you also wish to experience few moments of the life in Curion City, just like then, thousands of years ago, the only thing you have to do is watch on a summer night a theatre performance of an ancient tragedy here at the theatre. We guarantee you that this experience will be unique. The path leads you to the south edge of the hill, where the famous and very well-preserved theatre of the town has been preserved. The search for locations with good acoustics led the Greeks on the slope of the hill. Most of the times, the ancient theatres were set up on slopes of hills and hewn in a rock. The theatre of Curion also follows this rule. We remind you that the ancient Greek theatre is one of the few architectural shapes that were not surpassed throughout history. On the contrary, it responded to the new needs and passing through the centuries. It is still alive today, thus 2.5 millennia after it was discovered in Athens. Theatres are still being built across the universe, copying more or less the ancient Greek model. Just like in all ancient Greek theatres, three parts of the theatre can be distinguished, that is, the auditorium, the orchestra, and the scene. Auditorium was the space for the spectators. In the auditorium, there were rows of seats that could provide accommodation up to 3,500 spectators. Access to the auditorium was through passages and gangways. The auditorium is usually divided into passages, which serve the movement of spectators. The passage here was dividing the rows of seats in two-thirds of the auditorium's way up. Around the backside of the theatre, there was a corridor, which was connected with the passage through five gangways. The gangways between the auditorium and the scene lead to the orchestra. These passages were also used for the processions during the official ceremonies. Above the uppermost seats, there was a colonnade, encircling the auditorium and shaping a portico above the vaulted corridor. Between the auditorium and the scene lies the orchestra, which is the space where the choir was moving during the performances. The choir was a vital element of performances. It was the group that supported through singing and dancing the protagonists. The orchestra is semicircular and was closed on the seaside by the scene building. The scene, the space where actors were performing, was a high stone-made building. This part of the theatre was a very important element, as it was the most visible part for the spectators. It was usually representing the straight front of a temple or a palace, though the scene building was changing every time, depending on the types of performances. Each period destroyed the previous structure of the scene. Only the foundations of the scene have been preserved to present. The original theatre, built in the 2nd century BC, was smaller, while during the 2nd century AD, it was enlarged to its present shape. Archaeological research has proved the continuous use of the theatre for many centuries, through the Hellenistic and Roman periods. When in the 2nd century AD, the theatre was enlarged to its present dimensions, the scene building was remodeled as well, with imposing marble columns and cornices, of which some fragments may be seen south, near the ruins. The sides of the theatre were supported by three huge buttresses built with large rectangular stones. The next important change to the theatre occurred towards the end of the 2nd, early 3rd century AD, with some remodelling, like the addition of a metal grille, in order to stage the popular spectacle of the time, hunters pursuing wild animals. The three lower rows of seats were removed, and a metal grille was provided along the top of the arena wall, so as to place the nearest spectators at a safe distance from the orchestra, which at that time was the arena. Even now, the gangway at the lowest part of the auditorium, which was used as a refuge for the hunters when they were not engaged in the arena with the animals, is still to be seen. Towards the end of the 3rd century, the arena was reconverted into a proper theatre, and the lowest rows of seats, roughly cut and laid, belong to this reconstruction. In the 4th century, the theatre appears to be abandoned, and since then it has suffered serious destructions from the abstraction of building material out of its massive walls. The auditorium of the theatre was reconstructed by the Department of Antiquities in 1961. After its reconstruction, the theatre is used for cultural events. Its famous acoustics has not lost its quality. See for yourself. Stand in the centre of the orchestra. Sing. Recite something and hear the echo of your voice. The sound, crystal clear, reaches up to the highest rows of seats. Due to the marvellous adaptation of the theatre with the landscape, since the slope of the hill functions as a resonator, although the theatre is used today each summer for performances of ancient drama and other cultural events, just like all Hellenistic theatres in ancient Greece, the Kurian Theatre was used for the ancient tragedies of Aeschylus, Sophocles and Euripides, but also for the comedies of Aristophanes. Nevertheless, do not forget that the ancient Greek theatre is born in the rural feasts for the honour of god Dionysus and is connected with the religious worship of the god. Dionysus was a god who has been incorporated into the Greek customs and dominated, acquiring partisans, feasts and his own song, the dithyramb. The roots of drama and theatre more generally are placed into this choral chant. The first theatrical groups were then created with the volunteers, who were disguised as goats by using the sediment of must, trigia, and were dancing by singing the dithyramb, which was hymning the life and triumphs of Dionysus. However, drama continued its evolutionary course, reaching culmination with Thespis, inspiration in the middle of the 6th century. Thespis joined the choir wearing a mask, and instead of singing, he began to recite and reply in a repeated rhythm. This new idea became popular in Attica and constituted the landmark in the later theatrical history of Europe. Fourth unit, the House of Eustolios. Eustolios the Kurian, having seen that his fellow citizens were in abject misery, he did not forget the city of his ancestors. But first, having presented the baths to the city, he was then taking care of Kurion, as once did Phoebus, Apollo, and built a cool refuge sheltered from the winds. How do we know all this? But of course from the inscriptions on the mosaic floors that cover the biggest part of the building. The name of the owner of the house, Eustolios, as well as his Christian identity, is revealed through these inscriptions. And although it appears that the building was first erected as a private palatial house, after the laying of the mosaic floors and the construction of the baths, it was transformed into a public place of recreation, a kind of club. Having first visited the theatre and proceeding higher on the slope, in an also dominating position on the southeastern edge of the hill, we find the remains of an equally important monument of this ancient city, the House of Eustolios. It is a monumental house that dates from the end of the 4th, beginning of the 5th century AD. It consists of more than 35 rooms, which are concentrated around two interior courtyards and a bathing establishment of small dimensions. The building in its present shape was erected after the destruction of the theatre. Of particular interest are the mosaic floors that cover the biggest part of the building, which were completed in the early years of the 5th century AD, when Christianity was already well established in the city. We proceed towards the entrance of the house, which was on the western side. The servants' quarters were on the left, and just next to them, the entrance vestibule was located. Through this vestibule, the householder continued for 15 centuries, receiving and welcoming visitors through the inscription on the mosaic floor, which inscribes enter the residence in good faith and joy. The vestibule connects the forecourt with the central courtyard, which consisted of a garden, a small fountain, and a fish pond. It is surrounded by porticos. The colonnaded courtyard, which was also covered with mosaic floors. Around the peristyle, that is in the reception and public use areas, are preserved the most important mosaic floors. Following the walkway that was made recently by the Department of Antiquities, and proceeding towards the most southeastern part of the site, we find in front of us maybe the most significant room of the house due to the mosaic composition of its floor. The great importance of these mosaics lies in its deeper symbolic meaning and in the connection of the building with the new veneration, Christianity, which is indicated through the inscription we read in ancient Greek. In place of big stones and solid iron, gleaming bronze and even adamant, this house is girt by the much venerated signs of Christ. The householder reminds us that all these buildings here were not supported neither on big stones nor on solid iron, on blonde copper or on this diamond, but only on the very blessed symbols of Christ. The coloured decorative shapes on the floor depict symbols of early Christian times, like the fish, the partridge, the peacock, etc. On the other hand, in its southern wing, a fourth fragmentary inscription reminded those who frequented the building that this was the house of reverence, prudence, and piety. In the same complex of rooms, and proceeding more north in order to go higher towards the baths, we find the inscription which indicates the public use of the building, its connection with Christianity, and the name of the owner. Eustolios, having seen that the Kurians, although previously very wealthy, were in abject misery, did not forget the city of his ancestors. But first, having presented the baths to our city, he was then taking care of Kurion, as once did Phoebus, Apollo, and built this cool refuge, sheltered from the winds. The inscription refers to the donator Eustolios the Kurion. Having seen that his fellow citizens were in abject misery, did not forget the city of his ancestors, but first having presented the baths to the city, he was then taking care of Kurion, as once did Phoebus, Apollo, and built a cool refuge sheltered from the winds. As we may notice, the same inscription is also mentioning Apollo, Phoebus, as the previous protector of Kurion. The Roman baths. Continuing more to the north, the steps lead to the highest level of the house, where the baths were located. Proceed to the most northern corridor and stand so as to see the sea opposite you. The mosaic floor of a big room, which was part of the bathing complex, is unfolding in front of you. Public baths were a development of culture that was presented in the Greek space during the classical times and responded to a necessity that resulted from the growth of urban life and the rational organization of cities. The society was requesting henceforth the creation of buildings for exercising, for body cleansing and mind exercising. Do not forget the famous phrase that our ancestors professed, a healthy mind in a healthy body. However, in addition to their important role in physical and mental health, the baths constituted in all times a center for meeting and socializing, a place for communication and amusement. The architectural development of baths begins, therefore, in Greece in the 5th century. It is being crystallized in the 4th century BC and continues permanently up to the 1st century BC, when they were progressively replaced by the Roman hot baths. But how did the baths function? In their most simplified form, the Roman baths included in a row the room of cold bath, the room of lukewarm bath, and the room of hot bath. The first room in the row, the dressing room, apoditerium, and the cold bath, frigitarium, had a double role. Here, the visitors changed their clothes and took their cold bath. It was the best decorated room, which also functioned as a reception hall, since the bathers entered from here into the bathing establishment as such, and they stayed here, after having their bath, to socialize. The mosaic floor of the room has four representations in panels, Two are decorated with purely geometric patterns. One has a central picture with a partridge. And the fourth, in the northern wing, contains the only iconographic ornament in the entire complex. The bust of a young woman is depicted in a medallion with plait motifs, holding an object in her right hand that seems to be a standard measure. Actually, it is almost exactly the length of a late Roman foot. And according to the inscription in ancient Greek again, we read Ktesis, that is the personification of creation, the creation of the world. Off this central room, to the north and east, there were cisterns, swimming pools with cold water, and before each was a shallow basin for foot bath. The cold bath resulted after the advising of physicians, who recommended the cold bath due to the great benefits it contributed to the well-being. The room for the lukewarm bath, tepidarium, was situated west of the cold bath. The bather's sojourn in this place helped the body to progressively adapt from the low temperature of the dressing room and cold bath to that of the next one, the hot bath, and vice versa. The hot bath, caldarium, was located west of the lukewarm bath and was the final destination of the bather, who could also have a steam bath here due to the humidity of the room. Today, the only remains of the lukewarm and hot bath are the hypocausts. As their name implies, they were usually low and underground spaces underneath the floors of the bathing rooms, where hot boiling gases produced by the fire which was burning in the firing chamber, praefernium, were circulating. Floors were higher and supported on serried brick pillars so as to resist high temperatures. Walls were heated by clay pipes or clay flat tiles fixed in the walls, leaving free space for the circulation of the air. We also see the firing chambers, the hearths, whence the hot air was carried through the hypocausts and up through special flues and through the space left between the walls and the facing of the ceramic tiles. The operation of the baths required large quantities of water, which originated from the cisterns and wells. But the solution for the water supply of the baths was given through the construction of big aqueducts. The water was stored in a higher cistern and was carried through pipes in the various parts of the bathing establishment. The sewerage system, through clay pipes which ran through the baths, was also advanced. The water that was poured on the floors rolled to the lavatories, which were situated near the baths. As we have mentioned, hot baths constituted important sanitary and recreation centres, carrying out a significant role in the functioning of society. In these places, the citizens socialised, exchanged opinions, and spread the news of the day. At the same time, the politicians shaped suitable conditions for the guidance of citizens and the growth of propaganda. For the construction and maintenance of the hot baths contributed the emperor and other powerful leading figures, the city, the upper class, noblemen that claimed some high office and tried to become popular and ensure their election in a high office. The human relation with water is mysterious, almost metaphysical, and is due to the cleansing power, the purifying attributes that the water has. It is not accidental that the Christian baptistery originates from the Roman bath, the frigidarium. Don't you believe that current spas, sanitas per aqua, hydrotherapy is the modern development which maintains to a large extent the ancients' philosophy for the value of bath. Fifth unit, the early Christian basilica. Having first visited the theatre and the house of Eustolios, it does not mean that your acquaintance with the entire archaeological site of Kurion is completed. Coming out of the baths area and proceeding to the west, the path leads you to the central site of the Acropolis, where important monuments of the Hellenistic, Roman, and early Christian periods are concentrated. The remains of a large complex of an early Christian three-aisled basilica date to the early Christian period. This was the Cathedral Church of Kurion, which dates from the beginning of the 5th century, while the 6th century some changes were made, with the laying of new mosaic floors with marble. These remains lie in the southern part of the central area of the Acropolis of Kurion. The Department of Antiquities has placed on a higher spot the site's plan to be consulted for a better understanding and your orientation within the site. As you most probably know, in ancient times, Cyprus was an important centre of worship of goddess Aphrodite, the goddess of love. Her temple was situated in Pale Paphos, current Kuklia, and pilgrims from all around Cyprus and the ancient world were coming here. Despite the strong worship of the goddess, Cyprus became very early one of the first centres of Christianity. Apostles Paul and Barnabas travelled to Cyprus and put the foundations of the new religion. The dominance of Christianity in entire Cyprus was final by the 5th century. The construction of a significant number of early Christian basilicas constitutes one of the most characteristic signs for the important political and social changes which were brought by the spread of Christianity as the official religion of the state, but also for the new role which this new age was holding in store for the institution of the church. It is a fact that all religions, from antiquity